Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we talk turf with Doug Soldat today. He's a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, specializes in turf grass and urban soils. He does nutrient management, water resources, soil testing, landscape irrigation, you name it. And he's involved in it as it relates to turf and some other things as well. So we'll zero in a bit on lawns, and of course, we'll answer your questions if you have any. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Doug Soldat, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
You know, before we talk about my lawn or our listener lawns, I want to go back to the Masters Golf Tournament, because it rained and there was a lot of work involved. And I remember you telling me a long time ago about how the Masters Golf course is maintained. And when the tournament comes, experts from across the country come, do they not?
Yeah, across the country, across the world even.
Is that right?
And this group, and this common for a lot of golf tournaments. It's a challenge to get the course ready in time for the first group to come off the tee. And so there's a lot of maintenance that happens in the middle of the night, really, really early hours in the morning. And you need a big crew. So normally, you know, you'd have time to start on hole one and work your way through 18, but not on a golf tournament. You have to be off the course. So they bring in large numbers of people with experience, and golf course superintendents from all over the world will come and take care of a hole. And that's it. And they get in, they do their work, and they get off. And it's really amazing. And the Masters has been bringing in the same people over and over, so these people know every year what their task is and what they're going to do. It's just a really fine-tuned operation.
And you were telling me, because all the rain, you were mentioning to me before the show that they have a almost unique system for getting the water off greens.
Yeah, it is really unique. So golf courses usually build their putting greens, which is the most critical part to get drained, out of sand. So they drain really rapidly anyway. But at a place like Augusta, where maybe that's not enough, one of the former groundskeepers invented a suction system that you can basically turn a vacuum on, and it'll pull water. It'll increase the rate of drainage to get the moisture conditions back, so that we can see those shots that hit the green and bounce off. So it's really amazing.
It is. Thinking about, we've got the Brewers. They're doing pretty well this year, and yeah. And AmFam Field, the grass there, and that's all grass, is it not?
Yeah, that is Kentucky bluegrass. And, probably one of the things we'll touch on today is Kentucky bluegrass doesn't love the shade. And if you've been there with those steep walls, it has an open roof, but the sun angle doesn't hit it very much. So one of their biggest challenges is getting that grass to grow healthy with reduced light conditions. And they bring in artificial lights. So if you've been to a game, sometimes you see them rolling the lights out as soon as the game's over to give the Kentucky bluegrass the light it needs to form that dense turf.
The grass always looks just pristine, and the way they mow it.
Yeah, it is amazing. I'm in the profession, and every year I still say, wow, it just looks amazing on April 1st. So credit to Ryan Woodley and the grounds crew at American Family Field. And it's just fun to watch.
And actually, one of you was a former student, used to work there at least.
Yeah, we've had a number of our graduates cross through the Brewers, and it's a treat. It is. Yeah.
Well, now let's take a look at the Packers and Lambeau Field. Now, that's a different kind of setup, because it's not all completely grass, is it?
Right. It's most. I think there is a misconception out there that it's like a hybrid system, where it's partly plastic and partly grass. But so all these systems, Augusta National's putting greens, the American Family Field soil, and Lambeau Field soil are almost identical. They're mostly sand, and that's because they need to drain rapidly, right? So the difference between Lambeau Field and Miller Park and Augusta is you have 300-pound linemen digging their feet in and pushing it. And so if they did that without this reinforced plastic fiber at Lambeau Field, they would be slipping and the divots would be ripping out. So what Lambeau has is, it's called the Grassmaster system, and about every 2 inches there's a plastic fiber that's sewn in like a giant sewing machine into the soil. Every 2 inches, and you can't even really see much of the fibers or any of the fibers from the top. So what you're looking at on TV is Kentucky
grass.
Kentucky bluegrass. But if you get down on your hands and knees, about every 2 inches, you might see a green little plastic fiber that keeps the soil, helps it anchor, and keeps it in place with those big players pushing around on there.
Oh, man. It gets fascinating to me, and I hope to everybody else who's listening in right now. But I'm sure there are a lot of people that won't. Okay, I'm happy about to learn about Lambeau, but what about my lawn? Let's go to Jim in Waupaca. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Yeah. Okay. I want to ask about crabgrass pre-emergent fertilizer. You know, I've got about an acre and a half of lawn. A lot of lawn, and I got a lot of crabgrass. And every year, I put that stuff on, and every year the crabgrass just comes up like crazy and kills out all the regular grass. So am I just wasting my time or what?
Yeah, that's interesting. So one thing with crabgrass is the timing is really important. And the timing in southern Wisconsin is just about now. You're in Waupaca, so you're probably a couple weeks behind. But are you familiar with the forsythia bush?
Yeah, I understand.
Oh, you get okay.
The timing issue, and I'm putting it on right now. This is so it's early enough. You don't want to get too early because it all washes off.
Yeah, exactly. I think you might be a little early now. And I think the closer you get to the optimum timing, because the forsythia and Waupaca, my guess is they're not blooming yet. I'm just starting to see blooms in Madison now. So I think you're a week away at least. And that might be part of the issue, is to push the timing a bit later. And the later you go, the more effective it can be.
Yeah. So think about that, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Chris in Black Creek. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. I've often been curious. In Black Creek, of course, any village or township or city, they really don't let you grow your grass for long, but I noticed that sometimes if I go away on a vacation, I come back and the grass has almost seed sprouts coming up out of there. And I'm curious if I let them grow and got away with it with the village, if those seeds would drop in and I wouldn't have to throw seed and those seeds would plant themselves and help my lawn. That's my question, Larry.
Okay.
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and it does make sense on the face of it. But just the way that the grass plant, how long it takes for that seed to be produced and then mature, and then by the time those seeds shatter and fall to the ground, you wouldn't be able to maintain your lawn. It'll start to thin out. It would be, and it's normal for grass to seed in the spring, but by the time those seeds are ready to germinate, you're looking at fall, right? So it's like the entire season you'd have to go without mowing. And that's, of course, what grass producers do, is they grow this crop that you wouldn't recognize as a lawn, and then they sell you the seed. So if you can't really produce seed and then use that seed to maintain a lawn, because your lawn wouldn't look like a lawn anymore. I hope that makes sense. But no, usually the seeds that you see in the spring are not going to make it to viability. And if you did, it wouldn't be a good situation.
Henry emailed to ask if top dressing with black dirt, is that better or rototill and rake level? Can split seeding be successful in springtime? Should weeds be removed prior to any seeding method? He has blue cilia bulbs to remove since grass is choked out.
Oh boy, a lot going on there. Yeah, lawn renovation. This is a good time to think about lawn renovation. And if bringing in black dirt would be the goal, there might be to smooth out a surface. And so, for example, I lost a small tree in my yard, and I leveled it, and then it settled a couple years later. So now I have this 3-foot by 3-foot area that's sunk, and it's hard to mow. So instead of killing the grass and digging it up, what I did is I have some topsoil, and every week I'll spread a little bit into that depression. The grass will kind of rise with it. And so that's a way for me to slowly change the elevation with black dirt over a period of time. The other way I could have done it, which I think the question is getting to, is you could also kill the grass, remove it, rototill, rake it smooth, and start from scratch. So there's two good ways to do it. If you do want to incorporate seed into your lawn this time of year, shave the lawn down quite low. Get a dethatcher rake, go in two different directions to sort of create these slits in the soil that you can top dress seed into. And then good seed to soil contact is probably the number one success practice for getting grass to grow. If you just throw the seed across the ground without getting it into the soil, it's not going to work.
John emailed and wonders about a no-mow April.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There was a neighbor mowing lawn.
You're right. No-mow May, I think, is the
he wonders about
phrase.
No-mow
April.
No-mow
April. Well, no, April is a lot of no-mow, right? I was just over in Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and they have a lawn area that has a lot of early season bulbs that are flowering in it. And yeah, I got down on my hands and knees. There were pollinators there visiting it. So it's something that you can absolutely do right now is allow those early spring blooms to go. And, certainly grass doesn't really start kicking into high gear into Wisconsin until the month of May.
Yeah. Doug Soldat, our guest today, professor in the Department of Soil Science. We are taking a look at your lawn. Well, we've also talked about the Brewers' lawn and the Packers and the Masters as well. But questions for him, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Hey, Emily Ralph, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at turf and lawns on the program today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Questions for Doug, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Pat in West Bend. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I got a question about grubs.
Okay.
I had an issue about a year or so ago. Put down some stuff, and we thought we took care of it, replanted the grass, came back. Last fall, we noticed that it was dying again. And so this year, I went and got some stuff and put down, it was under the drop spreader, and hopefully it will take care of them. But at the same time, we found more grubs a little bit of distance away, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to do my whole lawn. And I was wondering if there's a little more economical way to do it than the stuff I bought was, let's say it's kind of an expensive side. I wonder if there's some liquid stuff that I could put down, or do I have to do the whole lawn, or what?
Yeah, that's a good question. And grubs are really tricky. So the most common white grub that we find in Wisconsin lawns is Japanese beetle. And understanding to get good control, you have to understand the life cycle. And so the life cycle starts as the beetles that fly around and chew on the roses and lindens. will lay eggs around the 4th of July, and then those eggs will change into grubs, and the grubs will grow. And by the time the fall comes around is when they're really big, and they're chewing on your roots, and you don't notice it as much because there's usually the temperatures are cooler and there's a lot of moisture in the ground. Then they overwinter, so they dig down really deep. These big fat grubs survive the winter at a deep soil depth. In the spring, they come back up and they start chewing on your roots again when most people don't notice them because, again, there's plenty of moisture and the plant can handle a reduced root capacity. Then they emerge, they fly around, chew on your ornamentals, and then they lay the eggs again. So the optimum time to control those grubs is actually around the 4th of July. If you try to get them in the fall or the spring when you notice them, they're so big that they're resistant to most treatments. And so the optimum time is around the 4th of July to use a product that's labeled for grub control that will take care of the next generation. So you might have to live with the damage that you're seeing now, but if you apply at the right time, you'll see much better success with that application.
And would that apply, that timing, would that apply across the state, south to north, or?
Yeah, there's definitely a window. 4th of July is generally
pretty good.
Pretty good. Good enough, yep, for most products. And we also have an insect diagnostic laboratory. We want to encourage people to make sure that the grub they're dealing with is properly identified, and so we can help with that as well.
Yeah. Pat, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Michael in Spring Green, on to you. Hi, Michael.
Hi. We just moved into a new home, and we had some landscaping done, of course, around the yard. And we live basically in sand in the river valley bottom. There's, I don't know, hundreds of feet of sand underneath us, and there are native plants in this area. I'm just trying to, right now I'm looking out in our yard and it's just pure sand, basically, with some remnant dune areas. And I'm just trying to figure out how we can approach this. What can we get to, like, in terms of native plants to grow, ground cover to grow in sand, pure sand?
Yeah, so native ground covers, bit out of my expertise. I mostly deal with managed turf grass species, and the majority of those in Wisconsin are not native. So buffalo grass is one of the turf grasses that is native and can do okay in sand, but we're right at the sort of very northern adaptation zone, and I've had trouble growing it, so I don't recommend buffalo grass. However, I'll say, in terms of the grasses, and this is only addressing maybe one small part of your question or your options, the fine fescues, Chewings fescue and hard fescue specifically, are going to be your best turf grass options for sandy dune type areas. Mm. There is debate about whether they're native to North America or not. I think the scientific consensus thinks that they are not native, but they're naturalized for sure, and can survive well. They're very low maintenance and look nice in sandy areas.
All right. There you go, Michael. Thank you very much for calling. Jack in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I do not like grass. I do not like work, and I do not like herbicides. What do you think about overplanting with clover?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of experiments with clover lately. Clover is... actually was seeded. If you look at the old Scotts advertisements from the 20s and 30s and 40s, they were selling grass seed with white clover mixed in. And so we're back to that now. And if you go on Amazon or maybe check out your local garden stores are stocking clover these days. But I see more and more of it done on purpose. It pulls nitrogen from the air, adds some variety, obviously has blooms that are good for pollinators and in midsummer. I think clover is a good option for some.
Will it last well in a lawn? I mean, if you got a busy lawn, it may be an issue or not.
That's right. So, you know, one of my pet peeves, Larry, is when people look at like artificial turf and they call it turf, because turf is a collection of living plants that can form a continuous ground cover. And of course, artificial turf is plastic stuff, and the sports announcers have just shortened it to say, oh, they're playing on turf. No, they're not. It's fake plastic grass. So clover is one of the few plants that can form a turf, which means it can survive. Now, it may not handle traffic quite as well as some of the grasses, which is why we like to incorporate it with Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescues. But for the most part, clover can form a complete ground cover and meet the definition of a turf.
All right, Jack, there you go. Thank you so much. Mac in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Mac.
Hey, Larry. My question is, since the last caller pretty much was asking what I wanted to ask, how about specifically this no-mow grass that you can plant? Has that been proven to be, long? Because my fear is, kind of like your hair. If you get a haircut, you cut it short, it will grow back. But what happens when you cut this or it goes too short? Will it always keep coming back just like regular grass, but it just doesn't reach the same height?
Yeah, so no-mow or low-mow grass is like one of the craziest. It's just all marketing, right? There's really nothing special about no-mow or low-mow grass. They're fine fescues. So when you look at the seed label in something that's labeled no-mow, low-mow, you're going to find fine fescues, which we've been recommending for these low-maintenance situations. They're not especially short. They're slow growing, sure. They look really good when they're mowed short. They look pretty good when they're mowed really tall. They're low maintenance. They're good grasses for low maintenance situations, but they're basically creeping red fescue, chewing's fescue, hard fescue are the three varieties that we recommend and find the best results with. So yeah, go ahead and use them, but there's nothing unique or special. It's mostly marketing when you see no-mow, low-mow turf grasses.
And those get mowed eventually, don't they?
You can. Like, so, for example, like think of Erin Hills, if you're a golfer. This is one of the most famous golf courses in Wisconsin. Their fairways are fine fescue, which is a no-mow, low-mow grass. And then the wispy, waving stuff that never gets mowed is also the same grass. It's very, very plastic. It's very adaptable to however you manage it. It's going to figure out a way to it's going to look different, certainly, but it's the same species that can have these many different forms.
All right, Mac, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Vicki in Eau Claire. On to you now, Vicki. Oh, we lost her. She had a question about no-mow May, if I'm not mistaken. And wondering, is it really a value? And what about no-mow?
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about no-mow May last couple of years. So, and I definitely have some thoughts and opinions that are based in some of the work we've done on it. So the thought behind this is that in early spring, the pollinators are, of course, under threat worldwide. And we want to do everything we can to encourage better pollinator habitat. In the early spring, if you look around, there's not a lot of things in bloom. And of course, one of the first things to bloom in can be bulbs or dandelions and lawns. And so by not mowing, you're allowing those plants to flower in an urban area and providing an important food source. Now, one of the challenges with no-mow May is, well, what do you do in June when you have a really long lawn? It'll be difficult to mow. It's very stressful to shave a lawn from 6 inches down to a normal cutting height. So we think a happy medium where you can provide food source for pollinators while without causing havoc later in the summer is to mow as high as possible. So many mowers will get up to 4 inches or higher these days. Most plants that weeds are in lawns will bloom below that cutting height. If mowing got rid of dandelions, we would never be talking about them on this show. But of course, they do bloom and they do seed below a normal cutting height. So mow as high as you can. Your grass will grow slowly, but we think that stopping mowing altogether might cause more problems than it solves.
Yeah, maybe skip a mow or something.
Sure, mow less, mow high. Less.
And what about that? I've been reading in some places where they say, you don't have to mow every week. Why not mow every other week?
Yeah, that's right. And so the best way to decide when to mow is by following this thing called the one-third rule. You might need a ruler to really do it. You don't have to get that.
Maybe the first time.
Yeah, maybe the first time. So the rule is don't ever remove more than one-third of the grass or your lawn at one time. Okay, so then figure out what that means. If you're mowing at 3 inches, if you're mowing at 2 inches, it means you have to cut the lawn before it gets to or at 3 inches, right? If you're mowing your lawn at 4 inches, that means you can wait until it gets to over five and a half inches long. That keeps the grass healthy. It keeps it dense. When you start violating that rule, you get thinner lawns, you get weeds coming in, you get all kinds of problems. So when we study the one-third rule, mowing it, it turns out to be about every 10, sometimes 14 days. But sometimes when the grass is growing faster, it's about every week. So you don't have to mow based on the calendar, but you should think about mowing based on how high your lawn is.
Makes sense. Jeff and Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Larry and Doug, I just want to bring up the point about, without discounting your specialty, Doug, what is the true value other than perhaps athletic fields that we've been talking about? The advantage of having these, you know, finely groomed lawns, acres and acres of it, provides really very little, you know, benefit to wildlife and pollinators and so forth. You know, why is the obsession and the cost and everything so important to us?
Yeah, okay.
No, that's a really good question. It's something that we bring up frequently on this program, is that lawns should have a purpose, right? We don't want to be spending and utilizing resources if there's not a function. So for me personally, my lawn served a purpose when my kids were young and using it all the time, and my dog would run around, that if I had other ground covers, that wouldn't satisfy that, right? And so you don't want to just mindlessly go out and have grass highly maintained and manicured grass everywhere, but there are purposes, and every person has a different idea, and aesthetics is definitely one. One aspect of that equation. It's different for everybody. So, you know, I try to give advice and do research that helps people that want a certain look in the most sustainable way possible, whether that be something like Miller, American Family Field, or something that gets mowed maybe once a year, but still wants to look nice, right? So, to answer another part of your question, lawns are important regardless of what we do to them, because they're one of the few spaces in urban environments where water can infiltrate. So they have ecosystem services, and it's really important that we maintain that. And the implications of how we manage it influences those ecosystem services. And so there's, like you said, mm-hmm. there's million acres of lawns in Wisconsin, and we need to get that management right if we want to do the best we can for our environment.
Yeah, good points. Jeff, thanks. Keith and Kiwani, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I want to make comments similar to the previous gentleman. I'm up in Kiwani County. A lot of water pollution issues with phosphorus and nitrates, and we got a dead zone in Green Bay due to that. And all three of our major rivers up here are impaired waterways because of phosphorus and nitrates, and our beaches get algae blooms. And we have a lot of industrial agriculture, which puts a lot of chemicals and fertilizers on the ground, which not all of it, most of it does not get absorbed. And I would think the same thing is true for golf courses, lawns. When you put phosphorus, nitrogen on the lawn, how much of that is actually used? But the water infiltration thing also, short lawns typically they don't slow down the water a lot, and that's another problem with the quick runoff and the chemicals and everything end up in our waterways. And I think people just need to be more aware of how much damage they're doing to our water when they put fertilizers and chemicals on their lawns. And thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You bet. This is why I do what I do. And this what you talked about there is partly what I did my PhD on, was looking at phosphorus loss from lawns. And there are many misconceptions about the environmental impact of lawns. So the first thing is that Wisconsin has had a ban on phosphorus fertilization since 2009, the ban is on application, but it's also on the display. And that ban was partly what got major fertilizer manufacturing companies to take phosphorus out of their fertilizers nationally. So there is very little phosphorus that has been applied to lawns since 2009. The research I've done has shown, and others has done, shown that lawns are one of the best strategies you can have to keep phosphorus out of waterways, because the main way that phosphorus gets into waterways is through soil erosion and runoff, and a dense lawn essentially prevents that. Think about agriculture. What is the number one strategy to keep phosphorus pollution to a minimum? It's grassed waterways. So grass cover is an excellent way to reduce phosphorus. Nitrogen's also another important nutrient, and lawns have extremely high nitrogen demand, several times higher than corn, yet lawns and golf courses fertilize at lower rates than corn gets fertilized. And so when we look at nitrogen leaching from lawns, which has been done for 30 years, we generally find leaching in the order of single-digit percentages of those that are applied, between 1 and 10% at worst, whereas corn would jump for joy if you had 10% leaching losses. So nitrogen is conserved very strongly in urban areas by lawns. So they have a perception of being negative in terms of nutrient loss, but the science says that lawns are very good at keeping nutrients out of lakes and groundwaters. Now, of course, you can mismanage, you can overapply, and that's things we work on. But in general, the perception of lawns being bad for nutrient and water quality is overblown.
And generally, there's plenty of phosphorus in the soil already.
Absolutely. And so the ban on phosphorus says you can't apply phosphorus unless you have a soil test showing the need. When people go to get soil tests, they often say there's no need for phosphorus. And
there we go. Keith, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jackie in Menominee, we go to you now. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And every year we played with plagued with Creeping Charlie, and I'm just wondering if there's a way to get rid of it out of the grass.
Yeah, do you have a shade?
Is it shady?
I'm sorry. No, it doesn't matter.
It's everywhere, okay. Yeah, ground ivy or Creeping Charlie is absolutely one of the most difficult weeds to control in lawns, and usually it's because it's a plant that prefers shade, and grasses evolved in climates with full sun. And so the Creeping Charlie has an ecological competitive advantage in the shade. There aren't herbicides are marginally effective against Creeping Charlie or ground ivy. The best timing to apply an herbicide is at the first frost, and that's one thing most people get wrong. So, you know, late October, early November is actually the best time to target a weed like Creeping Charlie or ground ivy. And the most effective product is an herbicide that contains an active ingredient called triclopyr, triclopyr. Is the active ingredient that has a good environmental profile. It's less toxic than most other conventional herbicides, and it is one of the best at targeting Creeping Charlie. So around the first frost, that's your best option.
And it's practically the first plant of the year to bloom for insects.
Yeah, it's in the mint family. It blooms. I think that's the other idea, is just learn to tolerate it, learn to love it. Purple flowers, insects like it. It smells nice. So that's what you to tell yourself when you lose the battle.
Okay. Jackie, thank you very much for calling. And on to Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. During the pandemic, my husband and I put in a small terrace. We live on a hill and we wanted a flat area for a patio. And everyone is telling me we should put in patio bricks. But I was thinking about clover. Right now it's a blank slate. I've had black plastic on it for 2 winters. So I'm wondering how to start a clover lawn and if that would be strong enough to hold up a patio area.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure that the clover will tolerate that level of use and compaction, but it's certainly worth a try. If you have the soil all prepared and ready, you could seed. They have micro clover and mini clover are some of the varieties that produce slightly smaller leaves, but they're all in the white clover species. And I know that I have seen them used commonly in yards, and I think, you know, with a patio, there might be more use there, but it's hard to see. I'd say it's worth a try.
Yeah, give it a shot and see what happens, Barb. Appreciate the call. Linda in Black Creek, on to you. Hi, Linda.
Hey, excellent program, guys. North side of the house, it's in shade and seems to really like to grow moss. Holds the moisture. Any suggestions? It only gets mowed, like you mentioned earlier, about every 3 weeks, if that, only because there's a few weeds in there. But do you have any suggestions?
Yes, I have one that you may not like because of the price of it. But so dense shade is a problem for most of the grasses, and it's also moist from what I'm hearing. So the only grass that your very last resort is a grass called Poa, P-O-A, space Supina, S-U-P-I-N-A, or Supina bluegrass. You can find it for like $50 a pound, which is kind of shocking, but it's the only grass that's adapted to wet, shady conditions, and it actually can do pretty well. So if you're set on having grass, you know, my first thought would be plant something else that that can tolerate that level of shade. But if you want grass, Supina bluegrass is going to be your best option. The good thing about it is it's relatively easy to establish. It may be a bit hard to find. One place where I know I can find it because it is such a niche product is seedsuperstore.com. It's not an endorsement. It's just I know that I can usually find Supina bluegrass at that site, and it's hard to find it elsewhere.
Hmm. What was the name of it again, the store?
Seedsuperstore.com.
Seedsuperstore.com. There you go, Linda. Thank you so much. Dave in Shorewood emailed to ask you to recommend a turf that's tough enough for a one-year-old Australian shepherd that loves to chase balls and frisbees. Does it exist, or do they need AstroTurf? The backyard is mud already.
Yeah. The dog park grass is tall fescue. So we've been talking about fine fescues as sort of the low-maintenance grass. Tall fescue sounds very similar. It's very, very different. It's got wider blades, stiffer blades. It handles traffic much better. So I would recommend you check out tall fescue. And it's usually mixed in with a little Kentucky bluegrass, which is good. But you want to find, if you look at the seed label, you want 80% or more tall fescue. And that's going to be your best chance of success for high traffic, high use.
Randy in Bulgaria emailed to ask if, that's a long ways away, ask if there's any way to control broadleaf weeds in turf with micro clover in it.
Oh yeah, good question. We've heard from Randy before. Yeah, micro clover. Let's say this is a really interesting problem, right? Because you want the clover to survive, but you might want to take out some other weeds that you didn't want. Spot treating is definitely one option. If you have to do a very large scale operation where you can't spot treat, the chemical, it's an older one. Many people don't get excited about its use, but it is actually not very effective at killing white clover is 2,4-D. So 2,4-D, the kind of original herbicide for lawns, clover is one of the things that doesn't get very well, but it'll get a lot of the other weeds. So, but my recommendation would be just spot treat other broadleaf weeds with a conventional herbicide or alternative product.
And I'm not sure if I've got this, but second, is there any supplemental active ingredient for triclopyr? He wonders.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that means, like a replacement for it. maybe. But no, Randy, if you want to email me, I'd be happy to get a better understanding of that question.
Yeah, there you go. How does he get a hold of you?
My email is djsoldat@wisc.edu.
djsoldat@wisc.edu. There you go. Randy, thank you so much. Michelle in Elmwood emailed to ask if putting lime in your yard is a good idea.
Yeah, the best thing to do is get a soil test. So Wisconsin actually invented the lime requirement test back in the 1800s, and that's what put our wheat yields ahead of Minnesota's. So the rivalry goes way back. But because of the beneficial impact of putting lime, there's been this misconception that all lime applications are beneficial. Get a soil test done. If your pH is below 5.5 or 6, the lab will tell you how much lime you should apply to maximize the growing conditions. But my experience, most of southern Wisconsin rarely needs lime. Northern Wisconsin is a mixed bag.
Yeah. John and Woodruff, will give you a chance. Hi, John.
I had a question about what's the best way to control oxalis and chickweed in a lawn.
I don't have specific control strategies in mind for oxalis and chickweed. I would guess that so chickweed, there's two different types of chickweed, so that might influence it. But oxalis is a plant that's similar to like a clover. And the best time to control those, again, first frost with a conventional herbicide would be the most effective way to back off on or to control oxalis.
But pre-emergent isn't the way to go?
Well, pre-emergent for oxalis or for chickweed, there's an annual version, there's a perennial version. The annual version, yes, a pre-emergent would be the right way to go.
Okay.
All right.
And is oxalis perennial or is that an annual?
I thought that was a perennial. Again, okay. I don't see a lot of oxalis in my trials, but
okay.
It's
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Doug Soldat, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Lawn Care here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your lawn today on Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. Pleased to have him with us, and thank you for joining in. Chuck in Prairie du Sac has a question for you. Doug, let's go there. Chuck, hi.
Well, yes, last year I had quite a few spots with crabgrass in. Of course, it died off over the winter. Do I have to dig that all out before I reseed?
Ooh, that's a good question. We've been talking today a lot about the environmental impacts too, and one of the reasons crabgrass control is so important is because it creates bare soil for a big portion of the fall, winter, and spring. So if you do have crabgrass, it goes to seed and it germinates from seed again. If you dig it up, you're removing the seed bank. And so that is a effective non-chemical control strategy to prevent it from coming back. Make sure you go down deep enough, definitely to the top inch, to remove the seeds that were deposited in that soil. If you remove the seed bank, the chances of that coming back are less likely.
Yeah, there you go, Chuck. Good luck with that. Ed in Northern Illinois, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon. So my question is good clover versus bad clover. So after listening for number of years, I let clover run wild in my three-quarter acre. but it seemed to be getting too thick in certain areas. So I thought I'd try and cut it back a little bit with some spectracide. And it turned out there was no grass there. There was just bare dirt once the clover died. So is there good clover versus bad clover?
Yeah, you know, I think this is the things that we're working on now, and we don't have great answers for you, but you want a mix of the two, and when one totally dominates the other, it's not working as intended. And so, I think some of the newer, the mini clovers, the micro clovers that are more dwarf are probably less likely to completely take over and dominate to the point where there's no grass left. So you could try to reseed, and some mixtures now will sell grass and a mini clover, a micro clover mixed in. And my guess is that's going to have a better chance of not allowing one species to take over. But what you're talking about is definitely an area that we need to continue to do work on to figure out how to maintain a balance between the bluegrass and the fescue and the white clover.
Nancy in La Crosse emailed kind of with that same question. She was wondering what's best, white clover or micro clover, or versus micro clover. Are there any cons to be concerned about?
Yeah. It's so micro clover is white clover, but it is a trademarked cultivar. So you can think of like a normal Dutch white clover is intended as a forage crop where they're interested in production. You know, the more can produce, the more feed it can make. Similar to how grasses, some of our Kentucky bluegrasses are intended as forage grasses. But when you grow a lawn, you want it to grow in a more dwarf habit. So the clovers that we want to grow on our lawns should probably be dwarf, just kind of like the grasses that we grow on our lawns are often dwarf. So that's why I do recommend, you know, certainly you can work with the clover that you have, but if you're seeding, if you have the opportunity to seed something, go with a mini clover or a micro clover, or Pipolina is another name for a dwarf type white clover.
Keith emailed, he recently moved into a house that has a lot of Japanese stilt grass, which is a nasty annual invasive. He'd like to know more about it, not to combat it.
Yeah, I've heard of Japanese stilt grass, but honestly, I don't know enough about it to give you an informed control strategy for it. So I'm gonna have to punt on that one, unfortunately.
And Tom in Muscadet sent a photo of dead spots under a tree. He's wondering what to do with the area. It's a sandy soil. The area has grown over the last few years. I'm looking at it now, and it's kind of beat up and dead.
Yeah. Growing grass under trees is difficult. Not only do you have the competition for light, so it's shady. The other thing you have is competition for water and nutrients, and the soil is sandy, which doesn't hold very much water and nutrients to begin with. So all that said, chances for success have to be contextualized by that. Your best bet is going to be with a chewings fine fescue. So look on seed labels, read the fine print. The chewings fine fescue is going to be your best bet for growing grass in sandy, shady conditions.
Karen, actually she called but couldn't stay with us. She has a problem with goat weed. Wants to know how to get rid of it. She said herbicides don't work.
Ooh, I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard of goat weed.
I wonder if that's a local name.
Yeah, sometimes that's a problem with some weeds is they have different names, but that one doesn't ring a bell to me.
And Mark emailed to ask if lawns in Wisconsin are deficient in sulfur. And would pelletized gypsum every 5 years hurt?
So sulfur, this is an environmental success story. Sulfur is an important nutrient for plants, and we almost never have to think about it because of air pollution. But since the passage of the Clean Air Act, we've been getting less and less sulfur that comes down when it rains as a byproduct of air pollution. And in sandy soils, agricultural soils have been showing sulfur deficiencies. Now, I have yet to see a sulfur deficiency in grass or lawn in Wisconsin. And part of that is because if you do fertilize your lawn, they usually will contain sulfur in the form of the potassium sulfate or the ammonium sulfate. So gypsum is calcium sulfate. Certainly will not hurt to apply it. I'm skeptical that many lawns would benefit from that application, but if you suspect a sulfur deficiency, you can get a soil test done, and gypsum would be a good application to solve that.
Yeah, and that's going to turn up on a soil test.
It should. Mm-hmm.
And the soil testing, there's private places where you can get your soil, but we also have a soil and plant analysis lab, do we not?
That's right, yeah. It used to be in Marshfield, but just recently moved back to Madison on University Avenue, so you can visit their website, and they have lawn and garden submission forms to get your soil tested.
Doug Soldat, our guest today. Doug is a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, talking with him today about turf, your grass. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your lawn with our guest expert today, Doug Soldat, a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, specializes in turf grass and urban soils, water, soil testing, a whole bunch of things. And I hope you'll join in with your own lawn questions. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Steph in La Crosse. Steph, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hello. Thank you for taking this call. So my challenge is we have on the edge of our lawn area, we've got this Canadian moonstone pesty plant that is a viney plant that it chokes out everything, and it, you know, has runners underground. We've dug and dug, tried to kill it off, and but it's right near a lot of lilac bushes and other trees, so we kind of want to be careful we don't kill the roots for that. And so it is just a stubborn plant. I'm going to try to be more stubborn, but I need some help because it's winning so far.
I'm not familiar with, does it have purple flowers in spring?
White.
White flowers in spring.
Yep, and kind of late spring, yep.
And it grows in your lawn?
It grows right on the edge by where we have some trees right next to the lawn, we have some lilacs, and it's kind of wound in and it chokes. It's killing the lilacs, which is really sad.
All right. So I don't know the answer to this one, and I feel like I've said that too many times today. So I'm going to give you my best tip here. This is a Google trick, and I think it'll give you a good starting point for results. Is you go to Google and you type in, is it Canadian moonstone?
Yeah.
Canadian moonstone control. And then here's the fancy part. You type in the word site, S-I-T-E, colon, .edu. And what that's going to do is bring up all the Google sites about Canadian moonstone control that are from university, usually extension education sites. And usually you'd expect to find several high-quality fact sheets that will talk about the identification and control of that particular plant. But that's, again, one that I'm not familiar with, so I can't help you live on the air. But that trick should help. So site:.edu is the best way to get those tricky results out of Google.
All right. There you go, Steph. Good luck with that. Appreciate it. Alan in Wausau, we go to you now. Hi, Alan.
Hi there. Earlier, you were talking about how grasses can be helpful in keeping contaminants out of our lakes and rivers.
Yeah.
My question is, compared to what? Now, I would understand that it would be beneficial to have grass over, say, an asphalt parking lot, concrete, bare ground, but really, can you really justify that?
Compared to what? Right. So compared to a natural environment that humans aren't existing into, it's an artificial landscape. Grasses as a component of an urban landscape serve that function. So they are artificial systems that they're the ground cover that dominate the urban area. Are there other ecosystems you could plant in your yard that perform those services? Absolutely. I was addressing the misconception that lawns are negative, right? So the phosphorus control is one of the clearest ones. Actually, what we found is a lawn fertilized properly with nitrogen reduces phosphorus loss to waterways compared to not fertilizing a lawn with nitrogen. And that's because the density that the nitrogen fertilization creates traps sediment, prevents soil erosion, and limits phosphorus loss. So we've actually compared lawns to prairies side by side, lawns to rain gardens side by side, and there are scientific published reports showing that lawns perform similarly to those other systems. So I am genuine when I say that a properly maintained lawn, which is a miniature prairie, can have ecosystem services and values that are similar to other ecosystems.
There you go, Alan. Thank you very much for calling. Walter in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Walter.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I'm calling because I have two questions. One is, when is the best time to aerate? Because I just did it, and I was like, well, I don't know if it's fall or spring, or, you know, if it's some other time. And two, what's the best way to flatten out some ruts from yard care that was done when the ground was not frozen, essentially?
Yeah, okay, I'll start with the first one. The best time to aerify really is the fall. It's okay to do it in the spring. The reason that we recommend fall over spring is because there are many weeds that germinate in the spring, and what you do when you aerify is you do create little gaps in the soil where a weed seed could germinate. In the fall, there's just far fewer weeds that are germinating. The second question, how do you smooth out a rut? It depends on how deep that compaction is. So if it's, you know, if it's on the minor side, you might consider rolling. So when the soil is moist and wet, you can get a roller that you fill with water and kind of roll it over the site until it smooths out the difference in height between the high spot and the low spot. But if it's a deep rut by heavy equipment, unfortunately, you might be looking at a kind of a micro site renovation where you kill off the existing grass, retill, resmooth, and level that area. A third option would be to, like I mentioned this earlier in the show, is to take some topsoil and every week just top dress a little bit of soil into the low spots, allow the grass to grow up through it, add more, and then, you know, by the end of the season, you might have raised up the rut level to where the high spots are. So those are a couple different approaches you could use.
There you go, Walter. Thank you. Andy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. What's on your mind?
I have a question about dog pee area repair. I have a Irish wolfhound, a male, and he produces urine and creates dry dead spots in the lawn. I've tried a lot of the yard, you know, quick repair dog kit things, but he has favorite spots and he just destroys it. I'm wondering if there's something I can do after he pees to neutralize whatever's going on in his urine that's killing the grass, and or if there's a grass seed that I could get that grows faster than it gets destroyed.
Yeah, this is one of the most common questions that gets asked, and the reason for that is it's really difficult to control. So it sounds like you're interested in doing something right after your dog pees, and if it's possible, if you have a hose that's hooked up, dousing that area with water is something that probably will work, but it has to be immediate. The thing that about dog urine that kills grass is just too high of a salt concentration. And if you dilute the salt, the grass will be able to survive. So that'd be the first thing I'd try this summer, is just dousing that area immediately afterwards, and you're going to see less kill. The other thing is, when you reseed those areas, perennial ryegrass is what you want to seed that comes up the quickest. Now, it won't outgrow the damage that's done, but in terms of recovery, that's your best bet for getting green grass to grow in those areas after they've been killed.
Yeah, or train the dog to go in one spot.
That's the best answer, is if you can train your dog to pee in a non-grass area, you're going to be happy with that.
that you'll be the happiest,
yes,
with that one. Andy, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate it. Justin in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Justin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question is in regards to lawn grubs, and I think in particular it's the European Shaper beetle. And my neighborhood, we've had kind of an infestation of them as of late in the last few years. And as soon as the snow melted, I noticed birds coming into my yard, and my grass was not turning green in some parts. It was easy to pull up, and I found a good handful of grubs in certain areas. I guess my question is, what would you recommend going forward from here? I understand there's a curative approach, which isn't as effective as the preventative. I know it's around 80%. But my thought was to put down some curative measures and then put down the preventative. But I'm not quite sure on the timing of that and how that would impact regrowing grass, overseeding during this time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so both of those strategies should not affect your overseeding, so you can go ahead with your plan. Curative applications in spring are very unlikely to be successful, so I think the best thing you can do is do the preventative strategy, which is to apply an insecticide around the 4th of July based on the European Shaper's life cycle, and that will prevent the eggs from turning into larvae and prevent the damage that's going to would have occurred this fall. So that means that you're going to sustain damage this spring, and you'll have to wait until the chafer emerges, which happens in early May-ish, and then no more feeding will occur. You'll have fertilize properly, reseed those areas, and then go with your preventative application around the 4th of July.
All right. Justin, thank you. Let's go to Lori in Hortonville. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, we have about an acre and a half out in rural Hortonville, most of which we have let go back to nature, which is lovely because it's full of flora and fauna. But in the past 3 years, we have burdock, and we hate to resort to pesticides, but we did that last year. I have even driven through it on my riding motor screaming die just to see if that would work, which seems to be off-putting to the neighbors but does not touch the burdock. So is there anything that can be done? It's really just overtaking everything.
Burdock, yeah, I think... Are you asking specifically about non-chemical control?
Well, that would be preferable, but I'm almost ready to do anything. We really hate chemical pesticides, but if that will get rid of it, then that's what we will resort to.
Yeah, it can be tricky. I think one of the non-chemical or alternative controls that we've talked about is a product that is high in chelated iron. So iron, H-E-D-T-A. It's sold under a couple different brand names, but it is a product that's usually quite effective on broadleaf. It basically kills the plant by iron toxicity. So that's something you can try. Sometimes it's iron X, or, you know, you have to look on the label and see the word iron EDTA. So that would be something to try. It's expensive, and you have to spray it on each individual plant. And sounds like you might have too many plants for that. Is that true?
It's probably like 30 by 50. You know, it's a big, it seems to be concentrated in one area, which is wonderful, but it gets bigger every year. We just want to stop it.
Right. Yeah. So it's, I think with the life cycle, again, it's a biennial or a perennial. The most effective time to get it with any alternative or chemical strategy would be around the time of the first frost. I think a lot of times we control the weed, we think about weed control when in the spring, and those control measures may fail because of the plant is moving things from the roots up to the shoots. And so it tends to resist or survive things that we do to it. But in the fall, when we're like, oh, we're going to go to winter and battle this next year, that's actually the best time where a plant will translocate things you apply to it to the roots, which will kill the roots. And hopefully minimize the return. The other aspect to that is that burdock produces seeds. And so the seed dispersal is another thing that that you have to contend with, and perhaps a pre-emergence application around the time of germination, which is usually sometime in the late April, early May, would be another thing that you could try. And corn gluten meal is another product that's a alternative to a conventional pre-emergent. It's a byproduct of corn milling, and it prevents seeds from germinating. So an application of corn gluten meal around now or in a couple of weeks, coupled with a timed application with the first frost, might help you get some control back.
Yeah. Dick in Chippewa Falls, you mentioned corn gluten meal, and Dick was wondering, does it work on crabgrass prevention?
Yes, and that's typically what we recommend it for, is to make around when forsythia are in full bloom, which is going to be coming up for the state in now to the next couple weeks. Apply the corn gluten meal at about 12 to 20 pounds per 1,000 square feet, and we've found excellent crabgrass prevention with that, and it'll prevent any weed seeds from germinating. The problem is you won't be able to seed. If you want to seed grass into that area, you won't be able to do that for a few months. But corn gluten meal is an effective pre-emergent herbicide that's an alternative to some of the traditional products.
Werner in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Werner.
Good afternoon. I'm calling with two items, two comments. With regards to dog pee killing grass and all that, a friend of mine recommended something which has really worked for us, and that is to put a tablespoon or so of unsweetened applesauce in the dog food, you know, morning and evening, and the grass does not get killed, which I think is amazing. I can't find it proven anywhere on the internet, but it sure worked for us. The other thing I wanted to comment on was with regards to killing weeds and stuff. Three years ago, I had a yard with bindweed in it, and I was told to nothing will work on it. All you can do is try to pull it out, which, of course, you kind of pull some out, and you never get all the weeds. So I was giving up on it. I found, not that I want to promote a particular brand name, but I found that there was a killer for the bindweed was Spectracide Weed Stop for Lawns, and it did kill the bindweed. And I think it would work on, like, Creeping Charlie and such, too. One thing I found also is that just one application doesn't do it. If it starts to wilt, give it another dose, because if you just give it one dose only, it'll come back with no problems at all.
Werner, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I think, you know, the applying things when plants are stressed, when plants are going to seed, when they're flowering, they're using their resources to do that. So yeah, absolutely. I'm not familiar with the exact active ingredients in Spectracide, but you know, that is possible, that the active ingredient matching up an effective active ingredient with your plant is a good strategy, and we have those resources here at the University of Wisconsin Extension with ratings for different active ingredients and how effective they are at controlling different types of weeds that you'll find.
Yeah, Werner, thanks so much. Appreciate your call. Mary Beth in Gladstone, Michigan, emailed to ask if anthills can destroy a lawn. She's seeing lawns that are turning to sand, and it appears the ants and the anthills are the culprit.
Yeah, ants can be really difficult in lawns. So, different species will have different colonies. And example, my lawn, I have two very large ant colonies, and you know, resulting in a dead spot of maybe over a square foot each. And so the reason for control is that you have to get the queen, and there's some different strategies for that. But in terms of the mounds can exceed the height of the mower, and definitely the sand will kind of squash out the grass. So ant controls is definitely a challenge.
Alice emailed, her husband just spent the week putting down dirt and seed and straw to cover some bare spots in the lawn, and wondering when's the best time to water during the day and how much water.
Yeah, see, when you're putting down new seed, I think probably one of the most common things I see is over application of water, but you just need to keep the surface moist. So it's more about how frequently you do it. So maybe just a light spray a couple times a day, morning, noon, night will be sufficient for most spots. But you don't need to set out a sprinkler and put down too much water. That can actually make it worse. So just try to keep the surface moist, and you can just feel with your hand if that surface is moist. You don't want it to dry out. So just a little bit of water frequently throughout the day, as frequently as you can, is usually enough to allow seeds to get a good start.
I'll tell one on myself. I was starting a spot in the lawn. I needed to seed it and all that, and I put the hose on it, sprinkler system, and then I forgot the sprinkler system, and it was all night long. And then I got my water bill.
Oh boy, the double whammy. Yeah,
it was a double whammy, and believe me, I'm not going to forget that again. William emailed, the caller that asked about goat weed may have been asking about gout weed, which is an invasive shade plant that has been widely planted across our area. Gout weed,
huh?
An invasive shade plant. And I'm not familiar with that one either. And here we are,
yeah,
out of time. But well, we can look up goutweed. And in the meantime, Doug, it's always a pleasure.
Great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I expect we're going to have him back, and we will do this all over again. Well, just looking ahead, our physical therapist will be back on Monday to take all your questions about all those pains, sprains, and strains that you might have developed over the last month or more. So that's Monday on the Ideas Network. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and have a great weekend.